From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C., where the air is cool and the politics are hot. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners like you, and we are so very thankful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, November 1st marks the Christian observance of All Saints Day, and the 2nd is All Souls Day for Catholics. Wiccans celebrate Samhain Litha on the 1st, and Wednesday is the Ashura fast in Islam. On Thursday, Sikhs will celebrate the birthday of Guru Nanak Dev Sahib. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Here's the type of matching that they do. Vincent Hardy Williams voted in Georgia. Vincent H. Williams voted in Virginia.
Okay.
So they said that that's the same guy.
Despite almost no evidence of voter fraud in this country, and by evidence I mean criminal prosecution, since voter fraud's a crime, an unprecedented number of states have taken steps towards combating this phantom menace. Last year, the Supreme Court struck down part of the Voting Rights Act, as you know. More recently, the justices protected early voting in Ohio, but then upheld a controversial voter ID requirement in Texas. And a bizarre delay in processing 40,000 voter registrations in Georgia has faith leaders and the NAACP demanding immediate action. But on top of all of that, an explosive report by Al Jazeera America claims that voters by the millions will be disenfranchised next week thanks to their names appearing on carelessly assembled lists of supposedly duplicate registrations. The report is by the best-selling author and investigative journalist Greg Palast, and he'll have the gory details for us later on this week's show.
It's time for the Church of Jesus Christ to recognize the full identity of all Christians. And so in that vein, we're asking all Christians, and especially at this moment, Southern Baptists, to come to the table with us and have a conversation about what that looks like.
Last week, you heard gay activist Matt Stalansky talk about the group Evangelicals for Marriage Equality and its online campaign to gather signatures for presentation at a Southern Baptist Convention conference in Nashville. We ask you actually to sign on. As it turns out, a delegation of progressive evangelical leaders and activists traveled to the conference to present the signatures in person. So how did that go? Well, we'll find out from Brandon Robertson, founder of the Revangelical Movement, who was there. But first,
new polls show that race is neck and neck.
Look at this, a dead heat.
It is too close to call, and we could be heading for a runoff.
It's been a remarkable campaign season. Ebola and ISIS have handed one party the opportunity to fan the fires of fear and portray the administration as inept and indecisive, a strategy the mainstream media sadly has eagerly buttressed in its quest for ratings. On the other side, we've seen an embarrassing number of candidates of the president's own party distance themselves from the White House and from the achievements they themselves were a part of. And a number of races have included the kinds of surprises that make for good reality television. We could sit back and enjoy if only the stakes weren't so terribly high for the nation. I am delighted to have Greg LaBelle with me in the studio with a wealth of experience in electoral politics and now an assistant professor of political management at George Washington University. Greg always brings a perspective that helps cut through the incessant noise of the electoral horse race. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Welton. I hope we can do that today.
Have you been enjoying the midterm election campaigns this year?
Enjoying is not the right word. Obsessed by them, yeah. Enjoying, no, I don't think that fits.
Is there anything in recent weeks politically that made you think, I can't believe that just happened.
I think the impact of the Ebola situation in particular has been surprising and somewhat frustrating. The Ebola situation sort of came together to sort of personify what people see as problems with the Obama administration was something that was surprising and frustrating.
Yeah. In fact, I heard someone just the other day say, well, this is really the midterm election of fear. How much a factor is fear in what will happen on Tuesday?
I think it's a significant piece. But then we think back to 2010 and we think of the fear factor around Obamacare, the death panels, all of that stuff that was out there. So this is not unique in that sense, but there's certainly been a lot of that at play here.
The media, as you know, has made a whole lot out of Democrats, quote, unquote, running away from Obama. How much of that have you seen happening?
Well, again, I don't think that it's all that unusual in the sixth year of an administration. Voters tend to get a little tired of presidents after 6 years. And I think that this president has experienced that maybe to a greater extent than others in the past. But it's not that unusual for this sort of impact to sort of settle in. When you think about it, 6 years, presidents almost always suffer losses in the Senate and House elections. I think Bill Clinton was the only one probably who didn't.
Greg, when you're in the classroom talking with smart people about American politics, is the president that negative a figure, or is he getting buffeted by a lot of partisan politics that make him look that bad?
All of the above.
All of the above.
You start with the fact that presidents tend to reach a certain nadir of popularity around this time in second terms. We add to it the uncertainty that we've been facing on the international scene for some time. ISIS, Ebola, the rise of Putin's Russia in Ukraine. These are the circumstances that all serve to add to that sense of uncertainty. The stock market in the last week alone, I think, dropped close to 1,000 points, and now it's back up where it was. There is so much fluctuation out there that I think people are just nervous.
Is the fear really related to the president and the Democratic Party, or are people simply scared because the economy hasn't come back as quickly as it should and their lives are just not going like they want them to?
All of those factors come into play, the economy, the realities of what we're facing on an international level. This all sort of comes into play in the way Americans are sort of looking at their lives and the presidency. I think what we're seeing is that voters are fed up with Washington. I think it's less about Democrats or Republicans or this president than just Washington in general. People have lost confidence in our ability to do anything in this town.
When it comes to the GOP overarching message, if you take out not Obama, what is there in that message?
Not much beyond that message. Republicans running for the Senate across the country have been running against Barack Obama. Just watch the ads from Kay Hagan in North Carolina to Jean Shaheen in New Hampshire to Mark Begich in Alaska. It's this guy voted with Obama, fill in the blank, number of times. Mm-hmm. They've tried to nationalize this election around Obama in the same way the Democrats have done in the past with George W. Bush and at one point with Newt Gingrich. This is not an unusual tactic in politics, but that really has been the message. Nationalize this thing around a very unpopular president right now.
Well, let me ask a similar question about the Democratic Party. The strategy clearly has been to stay away from the president, not be identified with him. But what is their message?
I would say it a little differently. I think that what the smart Democrats are doing and the ones who seem to be doing – I hesitate to use the word well – Democrats who are doing better than some of their colleagues right now, it's about localizing the election. It's about making it about the issues that are facing the folks in their states. And I think to the extent that they can talk about what they've done about more local issues, they are finding a little bit more success in voters' minds.
Mm-hmm. I know it's hard to generalize, but overall, who do you see missing more opportunities or making the most mistakes?
I'm going to sort of twist that question around a little bit, because what the Republicans have done well this time is avoid the kind of meltdowns that we saw in past elections with Republicans getting out there saying crazy stuff. There hasn't been that much of that. So that's to their credit. The result is they only talk about Obama. Whether that's going to work or not, I don't know. I think the other piece of this is mechanics. And it's about getting out the vote, because, again, we know this is a smaller electorate. People are less likely to vote. We won't know the answer to this until the day after the election. But if the Democratic Party has done what they have seemed to have invested in doing, we may see some races that don't go the way we think they're going to go right now. I think particularly of Mark Begich in Alaska. If Mark Begich's ground game, people on the ground talking with voters who don't usually get talked to, is as good as it appears to be, Begich may hang on to that seat. That's one of the big differences. The Republicans don't seem to have the wherewithal to be able to put together those kinds of ground games. And that's probably because they've never – traditionally, they haven't had to do that.
Yeah. So if you're the consultant to both parties and we're right exactly where we are as the weekend before the election, what are you counseling candidates to do?
I'm saying it's all about get out the vote right now. It's all about getting those folks to the polls. And there are different pockets depending on who I'm talking to. Republicans have to make sure that they're getting that core base of supporters out there. And I think they've done a pretty good job of keeping them in line by and large. That Democrats, on the other hand, have to make sure that those folks who traditionally don't vote, and there are a lot more of them who identify as Democrat who don't vote in off-year elections, primarily people of color who simply don't participate, Democrats need to get them to get out there and vote. So it really is about getting out the vote at this point.
What are the races that you're going to watch most closely?
You know, I think the three races that I look at, Montana, South Dakota, and West Virginia are probably going to flip from Democrat to Republican. The Republicans have leads that are outside the margin of error right now, some substantially. I mean, in Montana, Daines is up by 18 points. Louisiana is an interesting race. I think Landrieu will probably win, but Louisiana is one of those states where the winner needs to get 50% plus one. She won't do that. They already have started to do some polling with her against Cassidy in a runoff, and he wins that. And that's not a surprise. So she may end up on top on Election Day, but probably will not be able to hold on when we get to the runoff a little bit further down the road. Arkansas is probably gone. The numbers aren't quite as broad. But, you know, Tom Cotton's proven to be a much better candidate than anybody thought he would. Mm-hmm. Colorado, anybody's guess at this point. The difference is about 3 points. The way we tend to look at these things is anyone who's up by 3 points at this point is probably in fairly good shape. But some of these numbers have been so volatile that I'm not sure that that's the case. Again, I think with Colorado, it's going to come down to the ground game, who does the better job of getting out the vote. But if you look at those right there, if those go the way they look, the Senate switches hands. The mm-hmm. Senate goes to a Republican majority in January. Georgia, again, that's another runoff state. The difference right now between the two candidates is 0.5%. Kentucky, McConnell's up by 4. You know, he's been up since May. I think the odds are that McConnell will probably hang on to the seat. She's done a pretty good job of running against him, better than anyone ever thought she would do. He's put in $2 million of his own money at this point in the race. He hasn't had to do that very often. Again, Alaska, we talked about that. I think it's going to come down to the ground game. It's close. But if Begich is doing what it looks like he's doing with his get out the vote effort, he might actually pull that off. Shaheen in New Hampshire, I think, will be okay. She's up by about 2 by most. I have to say, I have never seen this many races this far down the road that were this close, that are well within the margin of error in these races. I think Shaheen will probably be all right, partly because she has such a good organization in New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. North Carolina is a dead tie right now. Not only a statistical tie, I mean, it's a tie. Mm-hmm. Hagan's been doing a good job. She's been in the lead to pull, which is surprising because this was, I mean, from way back, people saying, Hagan's gone, you know, mm-hmm. before we really saw some of these other races. So she's done a good job. Iowa, who knows? Ernst is up by 2. She's been up for quite a while by a point or two. It's hard to tell there, but that may be one that flips to Republicans as well. So, you know, Republicans could easily pick up 6 seats here.
There are some commentators, Greg, saying that we may not know who's in charge of the Senate until January 2015.
That may well be true. It's possible that with Louisiana and Georgia out there without a candidate getting 50% plus one, that we aren't going to know until those elections. But, and that also throws into question Kansas, because Greg Orman in Kansas has said that he will caucus with whomever has the majority. So he'd be very comfortable moving with a Democratic majority if that were the case. And the Republicans have been going after him, yeah, nevertheless, for his good standing in the state. When the time comes, he's going to go with the majority. And we might not know where he's going to land, yeah, until these other two races are settled.
How much difference would it make if the Republicans take the Senate?
That's a very interesting question, because there is a theory, and I subscribe to it, that in the long term, Republicans are now in a position of having to govern. They have not been in that position for the last 6 years, because the House could always say, oh, well, we tried, but Harry Reid wouldn't let anything through. That's not going to work anymore. Plus, both the House and the Senate are going to be bringing in more Tea Party folks. Some of these folks who are going to win out there, Tom Cotton being one of them, these are Tea Party folks. So the House and Senate under Republican control are going to be harder for their leaders to manage, even than this House has been for Boehner to manage over the last few years. These numbers, where so many Democratic seats are up now in this year, flip by the time we get to the general election in 2016. So a lot more Republican seats are going to be up. Republicans are going to have to be able to say, this is what we did. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be hard put to do it. So there are some who argue that losing the Senate may not be the worst thing in the long term, yeah, for the president and his party.
We've been talking since 2000. We've been talking about having a divided nation. And yet we don't have any precedent for midterms that are as closely contested as what we've got right now.
Right.
Does that mean we're even more divided?
Yes. And I think this is a much deeper issue or problem in this country, this partisan division. I think we need to get to the point, and I don't know how we get there, but we need to get to the point where we begin to look at some of the core principles of our democracy, the way we determine congressional districts, for example. I mean, that whole process has exacerbated this increasingly extreme partisanship that we see in this country. Members of Congress are rarely speaking to the middle anymore, because yeah, they're speaking to their corner, and that works on both sides. And that means the rhetoric is hotter. It means it's more difficult for us to get anything done.
And so whatever happens on Election Day, that's not going
away.
Greg LaBelle's assistant professor of political management at George Washington University and head of the Semester in Washington program, which means he helps drag promising young Americans into this sordid world of politics. Greg, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to seeing you again.
Greg Palast is a New York Times best-selling author and an investigative journalist who has been covering voter purges across the country for the past several election cycles. His explosive new report for Al Jazeera America aired in two parts earlier this week, and I am very happy to have Greg back with us on State of Belief Radio. Greg, welcome back.
Glad to be with you again.
Please talk about what you've found and how far-reaching what you found is.
Well, what we found is something ugly. We spent 6 months, and I had a whole team crossing the country to dig into something called interstate cross-check. The claim is that there are 3.5 million voters who have illegally voted twice. It's the same election, but in two different states. Now, that's quite a crime wave, because voting twice, two states, is a felony crime. You get 2 to 10 years prison for pulling off a stunt like that. I had a simple question. If there are 3 million illegal voters, how come you haven't arrested them? Who are these people? Mm-hmm. And we spent months trying to get the lists out of these states' hands. So the 27 states involved in this cross-check program, 24 are controlled by Republican elections officials. We finally broke through about a month and a half ago and got the actual list. I got 2.1 million names of supposed evil double voters who are stealing the election. And as it turns out, this list is nothing but a list of common names. No Social Security number match, no middle name match, no date of birth match, even though it was advertised as matching those things. The only thing is first and last name. So you end up with a lot of people named David Lee, Joseph Washington, There's a lot of Chungs and Jacksons and Kims on there. Basically, by using common names, they are taking out the voters of color. You're talking about black people, Hispanic voters, and Asian American. Because according to the U.S. Census, a voter of color is 80% more likely to have one of the 1,000 common names in America. There are 86,020 John Jacksons in the United States. But according to this thing, that would mean that one guy named John Jackson voted 86,000 times. It would be laughable. It would be slapstick if it didn't mean that millions of people are in the process of losing their vote. 41,000 people have already lost their vote in the state of Virginia, and that's one of 27 states.
Greg, I want to be dead certain that I'm understanding this. You're saying that the charge that has caused panic about double voting is false, and it is a pretense used in order to clean names from voter rolls that will deny people to vote who have a right to vote.
Yes, that's exactly it. And in fact, by the way, to find out if you are a double voter, if you are on the lam from the double voting police, you can go to aljazeera.com, look in the article that I wrote by Greg Palast. Halfway down, there's a box.
Mm-hmm.
Stick your name in there, first name and last name. We have a million names from Georgia and Virginia. And see if you are one of the double voters. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do to be nailed as a double voter, to have your right to vote put at risk, is to simply have a common first and last name. They know when they do this that they're going to get the John Jacksons, who are African American, and the Asian Americans are really very much at risk.
Who's behind this double voting panic?
It started with the Republican Secretary of State, Chris Kobach, who's kind of the Catherine Harris of 2014. He has said on television again and again that there are double voters, people voting twice in two states. He says really easy to catch them, but, you know, Obama doesn't want to catch them because they're his voters, and that's true. If you look at this list, it's overwhelmingly Democratic. That's because, by the way, black people tend to vote Democratic overwhelmingly, Hispanics 2-1 Democratic, and Asian Americans, most people don't know this, 3 out of 4 Asian Americans vote Democratic. So if you go after Asian Americans, you're going after Democratic votes. So while it's ugly in racial, the ultimate goal, obviously, is partisan. Now, I don't care which party wins. It's not my job. I've done exposés on lots and lots of Democrats and Republicans, but clearly this is something which is ugly partisan flavor, especially because it's using race. And they know. I was in the office of the Asian American Legal Defense Fund in Atlanta, Georgia, and there happened to be a gentleman in his 80s named Mr. Kim, which is not surprising for Koreans, and we found his name, Soo Kim, on the double voter rolls. Soo Kim is very much like John Smith in America among white voters.
Mm-hmm.
Soo Kim found his name, and he was absolutely upset, absolutely livid, not because his name was there, because he says so many Koreans are named Soo Kim. It's the most common name in Korea. And he said, what upset him is that they have my Social Security number. Can't they see that the other person doesn't have my Social Security number?
Yeah.
I said, I know that. They know that. They have advertised this. They have a PowerPoint presentation in which they advertise that they use Social Security number matches. So everyone thinks, oh, well, this is very sophisticated. They're not going to get innocent people. Inside the actual instructions for removing voters, it says where we have Social Security numbers, they don't have a lot, where we have them and they mismatch, the voter still remains on the double voter list. So even when they know they've got the wrong person, the wrong Social Security number. But, of course, you're talking about people on this list, 1.5 million voters that are supposed to be the same person have mismatched middle names. So you have all these millions of voters who are changing their names to vote a second time in another state.
Greg, what happens to a voter who's on this list when she or he walks into the polling place next Tuesday?
Ah, well, in different states, it's different. In some states, they will find that their name is removed, and they will be then given what's called a provisional ballot. It's kind of a placebo ballot. It makes people not scream when their names are missing from the voter rolls because you get to fill out a piece of paper. But provisional ballots, they're almost never counted.
Mm-hmm.
Because your name is or isn't on the voter roll. The only thing that they check is was your name on the voter roll or not. Not whether you were removed unfairly. That's a big problem. The other reason, by the way, anyone listening, boy, oh boy, you better vote. Because in states like Georgia, if you're on this double voter list, you are put down as what's called an inactive voter. Now, what does that mean? It's a term that they use saying you don't vote, even if you have been voting. If you miss this midterm election, if you don't vote early voting, absentee, or by Tuesday, you lose your right to vote in the presidential race. Even if you're on the list, you will have the right to vote Tuesday. But if you miss voting Tuesday, you don't get to vote for president in 2016. It's very subtle, it's very brilliant, and it's huge.
So if someone finds out that they're on this list, as you've said that they can.
Yes, they can.
What should they do before they go to the poll? Is there anything they can do?
Well, if you're in Georgia, get to the polls and vote. It will restore your right to vote. They're not knocking off all voters on the list. They're knocking off 10 to 20%, which, of course, means 750,000 to a million people because there's 7 million names altogether. So it's a big purge, but you can save your own vote if you simply, in Georgia, if you vote. In Virginia, you may get 41,000 people who've simply been erased. So you show up, they don't have your name, please insist on your ballot. But what I would do is I would check online at aljazeera.com, middle of the article, see if you're on the list. If you are on the list, please contact your county voting officials immediately and tell them, I did not vote in two states at once. I see my name here, and my name is missing from the voter rolls. Please restore my name. You can also go to your county board of elections or state, the Secretary of State's website, type in your name. Almost every state allows you to look and see if you are an active voter permitted to vote. If you aren't, you got to re-register, and you got to contact these people and scream bloody murder. In some cases, your vote can't be saved. In most cases, it can be saved simply by the act of voting itself. But if you miss this race, I'm telling you, you're going to not be able to vote for president. That's what's so insidious about it. Mm-hmm. And again, they are targeting black folk. We found that the number one cluster of evil voters, evil double voters supposedly, is at Dr. Martin Luther King's old church, the Ebenezer Baptist Church. And according to the cross-check records, in a building of senior citizens next to the church, all African-American residents, that there are 10 double voters, 10 people who are committing the go-to-jail crime of voting twice in this senior home next to the Dr. King's church. They let me go into the home and find these so-called double voters, and I found a Mr. Naylor. Knocked on the door. He had a Bible open on his table, and he put his hand on the Bible and said, I swear I have not voted in two states. And he said, by the way, he had filed a sworn and witness statement, which he sent to Louisiana saying, I am not voting in Louisiana. I'm only voting in Georgia. Please take my name off the Louisiana voter rolls or get my name off this list. He actually went through this whole rigmarole just to make sure that he could vote in Georgia.
Mm-hmm. What's the prescription for future elections in light of these kinds of attacks?
We have to have a commitment in the United States of America to the right to vote. Dr. King started the Voting Rights March 60 years ago, and just because the Voting Rights Act was signed a half century ago doesn't mean that the battle is over. The Supreme Court has removed the most important segments of the Voting Rights Act. We have to make the decision that everyone in America votes and get rid of the accusation that people of color especially vote illegally. If you don't make them show an ID that they're going to steal someone's identity and vote for them, that they're voting in several states at once, that they have criminal records which prevent them from voting, but these convicts are going to flood the voter rolls anyway. They don't care if they go back to jail for voting again. This is nonsense. We need to remove impediments to voting, not create more impediments to voting. And we cannot allow a system where a legal voter is prevented from voting, and that's what's going on. Too many elections are being won by people preventing people from voting rather than winning the vote.
Greg Palast is the New York Times best-selling author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy and Billionaires and Ballot Bandits, among other books. His investigation for Al Jazeera America is titled Jim Crow Returns. Greg, I've got to thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Anytime, Welton. You're an inspiration.
Brandon Robertson is the founder of the Revangelical Movement and an outspoken leader in the growing hunger among evangelical Christians to move beyond culture war issues. As the spokesperson for the new organization, Evangelicals for Marriage Equality, Brandon worked to gather signatures calling on the Southern Baptist Convention to reconsider its stance on civil marriage equality. And this week, he was part of a delegation traveling to Nashville to present those signatures to the convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Committee conference. Still in Nashville, Brandon joins me right now on State of Belief Radio. Brandon, welcome back.
Hey, it's so good to be with you.
I'd like for you to start by summarizing the mission of this organization.
So Evangelicals for Marriage Equality was founded with the mission of working within evangelical Christianity to change the hearts and minds of evangelicals all across our country about the issue of civil marriage equality. And what that means is we're not necessarily advocating for theological change, but we believe it would be a great step forward if evangelicals could represent Christ and the gospel a little bit better, standing for equality and for justice and for the rights of the LGBTQ community. For far too long, I feel, we've been outspoken advocates against LGBT rights. And to me, that just seems very problematic that we are called to be people of Jesus and people of justice, and yet we continue to tell the LGBT community that they are not equal and should not have equal rights. That just seemed like a contradiction. And so we are working to cultivate these conversations and help to change the minds and open up space for young evangelicals in particular to be able to take a stand and say, I am a faithful evangelical Christian, and I support civil marriage equality.
Mm-hmm. Tell us now exactly, what was the statement that you were gathering signatures for?
We launched a campaign to have 1,000 people sign our organization's statement of belief, and it's kind of also our mission statement, which is basically just stating everything I just said about our organization.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened with that was we printed out 1,000 copies of that statement, each with a signature from the people that signed it. And I had the opportunity to present it to some of the leadership of the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission down here in Nashville, just to be able to show them that there is a large number of evangelicals who are shifting on this issue, and hopefully to encourage them to make space for us at the table, because our perspective wasn't represented at this conference, other than us being here kind of as guests.
Yes.
And so we delivered that stack of statements to the Southern Baptist Convention, and they promised to look over it and pass it on to the people that need to see it. And I'm really hopeful that this will begin to open up space and cultivate more conversations in the SBC for people like me.
I'd like for you to tell us who went with you to Nashville for this Southern Baptist gathering.
Yeah, initially, I had planned on coming down to Nashville on my own just because I was really passionate about these conversations. And over the past 2 months or so, more and more of my friends began to reach out and say, hey, we're coming as well. And so I was down here with Matthew Vines of the Reformation Project, Justin Lee of the Gay Christian Network, Reverend Allison Robinson, who is the first transgender pastor at Calvary Baptist in D.C., mm-hmm. Robin Lunn, who's the president of the Association of Welcoming and Affirming Baptists, Jeff Hood, who is a pastor at the Cathedral of Hope in Dallas, mm-hmm. which is the largest LGBT church in the world, and a number of other people. And so there is quite a big group of people from all across the theological spectrum that are really interested in cultivating these conversations around LGBT equality and affirmation in evangelical Christianity.
Brennan, what feeling did you get when you presented that?
I think my overall feeling at the conference and giving that stack of signatures was that the Southern Baptist Convention was truly interested in trying to change their tone and trying to listen to other evangelical voices. But also, there was definitely a sense at the conference that the Southern Baptist Convention still has a long way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so, while they accepted those signatures with really a great deal of warmth, there was still a feeling that, you know, this is just the very, very beginning. This is just the baby step.
Yeah.
And that they're seeing the shift that's occurring and that they're responding with a more compassionate tone is very good, but there's still a long, long way to go.
Do you think there were conversations that got started this week in Nashville that will continue in a significant way?
Absolutely. I conversed with some of the leading theologians and pastors in the Southern Baptist Convention, and even already this morning I've been getting emails from some of them interested in continuing dialogue, interested in meeting again face-to-face and continuing these conversations, which is a total victory for me. That's exactly why I came to this conference. That's what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't expect to change anyone's mind, but wanted to cultivate relationships with people that I disagree with, because I believe that's how change can occur, only in face-to-face relationships.
Right. I tried to follow the conference as best I could from a distance, and I saw the kind of discussions and presentations that went on during the rest of the conference. I don't know whether there were specific discussions about your material and how they were responding to that, but what I heard was, and this was a step forward, a respect that I haven't heard before for people with a sexual orientation different from what these individuals would call the norm. But I did also feel that they were saying, at least for the homosexual community, that what you feel about sexuality is temptation, and you're okay as long as you reject the temptation, something that I don't think they would say to people in the heterosexual community. Am I even close to what that was like?
Yeah, you are absolutely right. One of the most striking things that came up during the conference was a conversation that I was having with a couple of Southern Baptist theologians, and they made a case that I honestly had never heard before. In all my years as an evangelical Christian, I'd never heard anybody say that the temptation to be attracted to someone of the same sex was a sin. And yet, some of these theologians were really making the case that even being attracted to someone of the same sex, that attraction in and of itself was sinful.
Mm-hmm.
And when that came up in the conversation, that revealed to me the center of the problem. If we are viewing the attraction as a sin, we leave absolutely no room for LGBT people in our community. We give them two options, really. One option is either to come out of the closet and reject the faith, because you can't be a faithful Christian if you're even having these attractions. And the only other option seems to be, frankly, ending their life. And that was something that was brought up, that if this theology is that radical and that extreme, that is the epicenter of this problem, and that is a conversation that I'm committed to continuing to have to see if we can work towards what I find a more biblical theology that says attraction isn't a sin, but is God-given, and orientation isn't changeable. And yeah, I think you're right with your observations at the conference, and that was a shocking observation for me as well.
For our listeners, if they want to get in touch with Evangelicals for Marriage Equality and follow that work, the best way they can do that is how?
The two best ways is our website, evangelical4equality.com, or on Facebook. We're very active there, Evangelicals for Marriage Equality. You can like our page.
Brandon Robertson is spokesperson for the new nonprofit Evangelicals for Marriage Equality. He's the founder of the Revangelical Movement and is doing very important work leading people of faith who want to move beyond the culture wars in this country. Brandon, as always, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio, and we hope to be in touch again soon.
Thank you so much. It was my honor.
Now, before we go, October 28th marked 5 years since the day that I sat in front of Judy Shepherd and President Obama as he signed the Matthew Shepherd and James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Prevention Act. That day was a culmination of more than 10 years of tragic stories and impassioned work from so many members of Interfaith Alliance and others. And I can promise you that nowhere in that room was there a hint of a feeling of political triumph. Instead, all of us were joined in a sense of watching history being made, of America becoming that much more of a just and, yes, a more moral place. I remember well the voices of the supposed religious right that were raised in opposition to including LGBT persons under federal hate crime protections, the fear-mongering, the overt hatefulness, hard to forget. I'm sure that brought in a nice amount of donations for the organizations involved. But as for political gain for the president from his act of that day 5 years ago, how many Democrats have you ever heard campaigning on having supported this important achievement? You know, it's remarkable how often it's conservatives who gain political benefit from progressives doing the right thing for our country. This very week, I was sent a clip of a leading right-wing talk show host predictably ranting and raving about the recent subpoena controversy in Texas. He blasted the mayor of Houston for demanding to see all of the sermons of all of the city's preachers and pastors in advance so as to censor them. But he zeroed in on her sexuality. She's openly lesbian. And implied that this is what's coming to every other city, folks. When that story first broke, Interfaith Alliance spoke out immediately against the overreach that we saw in Houston's actions. We stood on principle regarding the separation of church and state, and we based our response on the facts. The facts are so different from what this radio host millions of listeners heard him say that it's hard to know where to begin. The case involved an organized attempt to overturn an ordinance that extended Houston's public accommodation protections to LGBT persons. Five conservative local pastors were deeply involved in organizing a referendum, which crumbled when an inordinate number of signatures were disqualified. Organizers sued the city to challenge that action, and it was in defending itself against their lawsuit that city attorneys subpoenaed the pastor's past communications on LGBT issues, including what they said to their congregations. And despite all the facts of this case, that did go too far. Basically, it's likely the referendum plan, possibly including the methods that led to disqualification of some of the signatures, was organized in the pulpit. But our Constitution still protects that speech. And that principle must stand as being even more important than getting to the facts of any one particular legal case. But just because you can get away with something doesn't mean you ought to do it. Even if you can count on a parade of right-wing voices to obfuscate the facts and create a religious freedom scandal of unprecedented proportions with some blatant homophobia thrown in for good measure. As the mayor of Houston squirmed in the harsh spotlight of national attention and condemnation, as city attorneys hastily withdrew their overly broad subpoenas and LGBT persons and their advocates wondered about the ultimate fate of the public accommodation ordinance, a small act of mercy in a hostile and even dangerous world, I'm certain that there was celebration of a political triumph in Houston and beyond. Fox News host Mike Huckabee rushed to stand with the pastors even after the city reversed course. Duck Dynasty star Phil Robertson in tow, because clearly outrage should not be mollified by just eliminating the source of the outrage, not while the cameras are still on. But I am equally certain that what was missing was the sense of achievement we were privileged to share that day at the White House signing 5 years ago. The feeling of awe that an act making this place we call home just a little bit better, a little bit safer, a little more just for our brothers and sisters, actually had our fingerprints on it. At the close of that signing ceremony for the hate crimes bill, Judy Shepherd and I embraced tightly with tears in her eyes. I whispered to Judy what I wanted to shout to the world. She had to pay way too high of a price to get that legislation passed. The hate crimes bill cannot bring back the life of her son who was killed in a hate crime so egregious that it gave impetus to getting a meaningful hate crimes bill on the books. No one should have to give so much, neither Judy Shepherd nor the family of James Byrd Jr. In the so-called land of the free and home of the brave, people should be rushing to line up to lend their support for fulfilling the promises in our Constitution and for assuring that every citizen in this land is treated with dignity and respect, equality in rights, and security for just living. Well, friends, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. A big thank you to listeners who've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters and do it today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. We make this show very easy to share. Sign up for our podcast at stateofbelief.com. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. And share the stories you find compelling with your friends. The same goes for Twitter. We're at twitter.com/stateofbelief. It's a great way for you to be an active part of getting these important voices to reach more people at a time when the noise in social media threatens to drown them out. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today, a member of Interfaith Alliance. Go to interfaithalliance.org and join us. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Before then, vote if you haven't already. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.